My name is Richard Lisher. The title of this lecture is Grace Unfolding. Yesterday I said that preaching will reclaim its own integrity when it reclaims the promise. That's a statement most Lutherans will not only agree with, but viscerally so. I also said that one part of the rhetoric of promise is its narratability. Not only is the promise capable of narration, it must be narrated. In this lecture, I propose to say why. However, I do so with a certain reluctance, for in this decade, as you know, story, in all theological disciplines, including theology, biblical studies, and ethics, but most especially in homiletics, story has become a cottage industry. In the past 5 years, we have seen such books as The Homiletical Plot, Doing Time in the Pulpit, Telling the Story, Preaching the Story, and The Song in the Story. But we can't dismiss so pervasive a preoccupation as a fad until we have come to an appreciation of the genuine contribution made by the theoreticians and practitioners of story. It's another lecture, I think, to trace out all the factors in the emergence of the narrative consciousness. One could speak of the first critical probes that drove a wedge between the great biblical stories on the one hand and what really happened and happens in the world as we know it on the other. 18th and 19th century scientific history snuffed out delight in biblical narratives but contributed to the importance of the novel and the rise of historical consciousness. Darwin showed that the human being has no timeless platform outside the evolution of nature. Marx claimed that the perennial social economic indicators such as wealth and poverty are not given by providence, but that social wretchedness has a history in which all are involved. Freud and Freudian analysts wrote a new kind of history when they described neuroses not as inherited humors, but as participants in their own story or myth, the Oedipal. Of course, we Lutherans have roots deeper than modernity. We are inheritors of a profoundly ambivalent attitude towards story. On many occasions, Luther expressed his disdain for mere history or historical faith. In much of his preaching, he dispenses with, quote, the history, unquote, as quickly as possible, in order to get at the good stuff, namely justification by faith, law and gospel, the two kingdoms, and other theological teachings. His preference for the discourses of Jesus, as in John, and the benefits of salvation, as in Paul, above the mere history of events is well known. His definition of the gospel as a summons, offer, call, or sermon, in short, a kerygma, gives the impression of a message heard at a split second in time rather than a story told over time. The history of Israel or Jesus as told by, quote, the mob of preachers may be heard by anyone, but only a kerygmatic interpretation of that history can be used by the believer. Of the so-called preferred preachers, Luther complained, and this is a long quotation, "But they are praised because the common people admire them when they hear them tell stories and examples and play with words and allegories. In this, too, I am a master. But no one is judged eloquent on the article of justification. Nor do people like to hear him or praise him. Take this as a sure sign that the common people sleep and cough when we preach the article of justification, but prick up their ears at stories." Yet it is the same Luther who can define gospel in this way, quote, "For gospel is and should be nothing else than a discourse or story about Christ, just as happens among men when one writes a book about a king or a prince, telling what he did, said, and suffered in his day." End of quote. And it's the same Luther who in his more memorable sermons does not dispense with history, as he called it, but lingers over it and elaborates it like a theme in a fugue or a figure in a tapestry. In these sermons, Luther does not pronounce the gospel as much as he arrives at it. He does not abstract the theological points he wishes to make, but renders them by retelling the biblical narrative in such a way as to clothe the story in the humanity, experience, suffering, and joys of his hearers. Luther's famous mathematical point at which the soul is penetrated by God's grace is not hidden in some transcendental region, but like the incarnation itself is clothed and elongated by the stuff of human experience. We need not apologize for enjoying the texture and art of Luther's preaching, as if these qualities should be shunted aside in favor of theological themes. Indeed, Luther of all people would propose theological, that is, incarnational reasons, for not separating the thing itself from its vesture. After all, how can God be pro nobis without the heaviness of a teenager's body, a stinking stable, a manger, and the swaddling clothes? For my purposes, when I use story or narrative, I really mean plot. E.M. Forster, the novelist, says, "A story is a narrative of events arranged in a time sequence. Story contains other elements such as character, setting, motivation, point of view. But most of all, according to Aristotle, it is governed by mythos, or plot. A plot is a narrative of events, the emphasis falling on causality. A story answers what happened next. A plot tells why. The king died and then the queen died is a story. The king died, and then the queen died of grief, is a plot. The people who read stories or listen to sermons are doing the same thing as those who page through their photo albums or recline on the psychiatrist's couch. They're looking for a plot. They're looking for a purpose or meaning that links up with other plots and participates in an overarching plot, whose surprises and conflicts they pray will eventually find resolution. So stories are interesting because they are about our favorite subject, us. What kind of stories does he like? Asks a character in Winnie the Pooh. About himself, says Christopher Robin, because he's that sort of bear. A human interest story is not merely one type of story. It's the only story there is, because we're that sort of bear. A good story tells its hearers what something or someone is like. It reproduces the human experience of some facet of reality. It engages in some form of imitation. The imitation need not be photographic, as Aristotle might have said it today. That is, it need not describe, quote, the thing that has happened, as Aristotle says in the Poetics, chapter 9, but the kind of thing, as he says, that might happen. In tragedy, he continues, the audience is moved with pity not merely by the suffering of another person, but by the undeserved misfortune of one like ourselves. The importance of realism, which we've alluded to in preaching, is, according to Aristotle, that it creates empathy. The quest for empathy is touchingly demonstrated in Augustine's introduction to his autobiography, where he asks, quote, why do the readers wish to hear from me what sort of man I am? The hopefulness of his answer depends in part upon the power of empathy aroused by his story. Augustine continues, when others read of these past sins of mine or hear about them, their hearts are stirred so that they no longer lie listless in despair. Stories tell us who we are. The identity-forming process begins with the stories we whisper into the ears of sleepy children, of villainous pharaohs and brave prophets, of children who welcomed a king on a donkey. Nor are the stories finished until the child's own place in the process is secured, and he or she can begin the recital anew. The adopted child, furrowing her brow over God's choice of Israel, repeatedly asks her parents to recount the events surrounding her own adoption. No word may be omitted from the formula. And then of all the babies, you chose me, right? Many families stake their identity on the history of their forebears. Our family arrived in Plymouth in 1620, one might say, or others, our people arrived in Georgia in chains. Likewise, a nation lives by its stories. Valley Forge, Gettysburg, Lady Liberty, the New Frontier, Iacocca. When I was growing up, the tape I heard most regularly was the story of the Great Depression, a story that, if heard often enough, will induce economic caution in even the most profligate of children. What are the stories my children will remember, by which their lives will be secretly shaped? These stories may mask as much as they reveal, but they are ours. The stories we tell ourselves and others are like dredging machines used to hollow out a great canal. With every pass, they cut deeper into the strata of our psyches and reinforce our identity as historical, plot-like creatures. Niebuhr and Augustine before him were right. Time is in us. Repeat the story often enough and it becomes a participatory event that includes a new community of tellers and hearers. Any good story is existential. As I read Elie Wiesel's Night or Alice Walker's The Color Purple, both of which are far removed from my world, I am nonetheless drawn to identify with characters and situations not because the stories resemble my story, but because they touch a basal nerve connecting all human beings. They do more than describe the kind of thing that might happen. The listener's participation in a biblical text takes place at a level deeper than Aristotelian empathy. When Moses prepared the second generation of Israelites to enter Canaan, he spoke as if they themselves and not their fathers and mothers had been delivered from Egypt. He did this not because Hebraic anthropology included a notion of corporate personality, nor was it due to the literary power of the story itself. Rather, he could say to those people, "You came out of Egypt," because in the Exodus, God had created a corporateness in Israel, both familial and linear. The most religious function of a story lies in its orderliness and its repetition. Any story that moves from complication to resolution can be an act of hope in the orderliness of things, a way of keeping the wolf of chaos from the door, of getting through the night. Tell me again, then, of all the little girls, you chose me, right? Tell me again why this Passover night is different from all other nights. Then of all the nations and peoples on earth, you chose us, right? Tell me again, says the church, surrounded by persecution, unbelief, and secularism, how exactly was it on the night he was betrayed? The novelist Isaac Dinesen claims, any sorrow can be borne if a story can be told about it. Yet the caveat to all romanticized tributes to story must be, not any old story will do. How quickly any story can degenerate into our ideology by which outsiders are subjugated or kept out. How quickly a good story, like Rocky, becomes an ideology for American individualism. Or a simple child's game of cowboys and Indians perpetuates the big lie of manifest destiny. How easily the Bible's own story of the conquest of Canaan can be used by Afrikaners to justify oppression. And what of Aristotle's insistence on imitation, realism, and empathy? How do the canned happy endings of too many sermon illustrations conjure a real world? What of the bad endings that resist resolution and the tragedies that appear to be plot resistant? No, not any story will do. Another story is needed. Lutheran ethicist Gilbert Mylander reminds us that one of the oldest metaphors for the Christian life is the journey. Even those who live in the same town their whole lives and who will die in the same bedroom where they were born think of their life as a journey. But where'd you go? One might ask. Oh, nowhere much. They traveled all the way from baptism to the brink of heaven. That's some trip. For the people of God, the journey began when Abraham was called to travel to a new land and given a promise that would include multitudes. How else could the master poets, who incidentally tell us nothing about the theory of their art, portray this journey but by story? Preachers will continue to narrate the promise until God makes it come true in its fullest sense. In the meantime, the church is a communio viatorum, a company of immigrants, moving as real-life characters in an unfinished story. Within this story, the pilgrim church enacts another great metaphor for the Christian life, the dialogue. Dialogue is a peculiarly Judeo-Christian metaphor, for our common tradition centers in call and response, judgment and repentance, gift and faith, command and obedience, yes and no, no and yes. Dialogue means that every second we live coram Deo. For Christians, the dialogue reaches its climax in the perfect dialogue between the Father and the Son, when even God's sternest no was met with a yielding acceptance of Jesus' yes. The literary form of the story captures the sweep of the journey. In some respects, the Bible is a historical or dramatic epic. One thinks of Roots or the Orestia trilogy, whose plot unfolds over many generations against a rich and changing backdrop of world events. The epic tells of a God involved with a band of slaves whose adventures carry them from the Egypt of the Pharaohs to the Rome of the Caesars. As the adventure continues, Israel and now the church accumulates a history to which it strains in hope, to which it looks for assurance and a future toward which it strains in hope. But the Bible also contains prophetic tracts or sermons by which the dialogue between God and God's people is sustained. Biblical literature is agonistic, pitting opposites against one another. It projects a spiral of conflicts between chaos and order, bondage and deliverance, death and resurrection, flesh and spirit, whose ferocity is meant to drive us back to the original promise and to trust it again and again. That's what sermons do. They tell the story of the promise, and in doing so, they passionately urge it and transact it. Even the pure narration of the Gospels is far removed from simple history. When the form critic DeBalius declared, "In the beginning was the sermon," he rightly understood that there is no art for art's sake in the New Testament. The New Testament Gospels are oratorical, as one critic puts it. They are designed to take you by the lapels and preach. So Luther also sought in each text, "Vos Christum tribet," that which urges Christ. So erupting from the narrative of the Bible, we have the direct confrontation of dialogue. Who shall I send, and who will go for us? Here am I, send me. But who do you say that I am? You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. The dialogue is as natural as a conversation over morning coffee, and as essential as the creature's need to answer the Creator. What do the journey and the dialogue have to do with preaching? First this, that our sermons need both the story and the punctuation of that story by direct address, confrontation, and claim. The second point derives from the first. Preachers should not embrace narrative preaching on the basis of psycho-literary properties of the narrative genre itself. This is another form of foundationalism, whereby the gospel depends on other philosophical, biological, or literary prerequisites. Some of the claims now made for the narrative genre were once made in a different form for rational logic. Christians invest in narrative because the witness to God's self-revelation takes the peculiar form of a narrated promise in which people like us can participate. But we participate in God's story not the way we participate in a gripping novel, that is, not because of the inherent powers of the narrative itself, but because it is God who is committing himself to such language, and it is God who, through baptism, is incorporating us into the divine life and the divine story. These may seem like small and obvious points, but in light of the many ways in which preachers use the term story, they perhaps need saying. What does the average preacher mean when he or she says, "I am a narrative preacher," or "I see myself as a storyteller"? By story, some mean nothing more than the illustrations, anecdotes, testimonies, legends, and jokes with which preachers have enlivened their points and spiced their sermons since some homilist in the primitive church said, "That reminds me of a funny thing that happened to me on the way to the catacombs." Many such preachers will say, "Story theology, so what else is new? We've been telling stories a long time," by which they usually mean sermon illustrations. The sermon illustration comes under the heading of what C.S. Lewis calls a master's metaphor. The master, or shall we say the teacher, has command of a particular truth and wishes to impart it to the learners. In order to do so, he or she will announce the truth, usually in the form of a proposition, and then cast light upon it with a figure, anecdote, testimony, or story. This is a legitimate, useful, if sometimes predictable use of story. A second preacher may have in mind a particular genre of story perfected in the black church, the preacher's own conversion story, whose formulaic repetition is a convention in some traditions. Now, just as I, as a staid Lutheran with an instinctive horror of subjectivism or enthusiasm, am about to say something snide about this use of story, I open my Bible and I hear the apostle saying, "As I made my journey and drew near to Damascus, about noon, a great light," a story Luke repeats three times in Acts. Moreover, this is the same apostle who in Romans 2, verse 16, uses the phrase, "according to my gospel," by which he does not mean a word particular to him or peculiar to him, but one which has convicted and claimed his whole being. As surely as Paul's conversion experience put the stamp on his gospel, so Luther's experience of God's righteousness opened the gates of heaven to him and gave distinctive power to his preaching. And so our experience of the gospel influences our proclamation of it. But remember, the genuine witness to the power of God in one's life is one thing. Introspection, preoccupation with the self, and embarrassing self-revelations, that's quite another. Only the Gnostic Gospels counsel salvation through navel-gazing. A third group of preachers may use the word story to mean indirect discourse, parable, metaphor, and the use of secular literature in a post-Christian society that for many reasons has become immune to the divine story, the way the chronically ill may be desensitized to good medicine. Christendom is so saturated with the biblical narrative that the only way one can hear it is by means of indirection. This is the preaching theory of Fred B. Craddock, who takes two texts, one from Kierkegaard, the other from 1 John. Kierkegaard wrote in his concluding unscientific postscript, "There is no lack of information in a Christian land. Something else is lacking, and this is a something that one man cannot directly communicate to another." And from 1 John, "I write to you not because you do not know the truth, but because you know it." So it is the preacher's task to create or find stories which do not oppress the secular listener with their overt truth claims, but which awaken in the listener a distant recollection of something he or she, at some level, already knows. The stories may be drawn from ordinary experience, and those are the best kinds, are from Woody Allen or Kafka, it doesn't matter. Such stories are related to the biblical faith, as the stranger you meet at your 25-year class reunion is related to the boy or girl who was your high school sweetheart. You see him or her, and something buried within you wakes up. The contemporary listener can no longer hear either the content or the claim of the gospel. But in the skillful sifting of ordinary experience and in the telling of stories that parallel or shadow the biblical story, the listener overhears the gospel, much in the way adults listen in on the children's sermon and then insult the preacher by saying, "I get more out of your little talks with the kids than I do from the main event." Or the way Pharisees were stung by what they overheard Jesus saying to others. In addition to the parables of Jesus, one of the classic examples of story as an indirect means of recognition is Nathan's little homily to David. David is drawn deeply into the narrative until it turns to quicksand. Of course, there is so much that is helpful and biblical in this approach. However, reliance on indirection is fraught with theoretical and practical difficulties. One begins with a question concerning the accuracy of Kierkegaard's and Craddock's diagnosis and asks, is it in fact the case that our culture is so saturated with Christianity that it, or we, cannot hear the Christian message? Is it really that our society has too much information, or does it know next to nothing? In a pluralistic society like ours, is it even possible to generalize on Christendom's capacity to hear? What moves Jimmy Swaggart's share of the audience leaves yours and mine cold. In a media atmosphere in which subtlety suffers from low Nielsen ratings, the methods of indirection won't work. We would all like to think that we minister in what Robert Bella calls communities of memory. But in fact, most of our listeners inhabit what he calls lifestyle enclaves. Communities of memory are holistic and inclusive, with roots deep in their own tradition. Communities of memory function corporately according to a transcendent purpose. Lifestyle enclaves are subdivisions, condos, clubs, or other complexes of individualism, characterized by mobility and anonymity. Like very small children, their inhabitants play next to one another, but not with one another. They are bound together by a lifestyle of consumption and nurtured by no common tradition other than the amorphous values of civil religion. Now, before the church points its finger at the lifestyle enclaves out there, we need to see the extent to which the out there is in here. Old-fashioned American Emersonian individualism dies hard. A 1978 Gallup poll found that 80% of Americans agreed that, quote, an individual should arrive at his or her own religious beliefs independent of any churches or synagogues, end of quote. And this in Christian America. We spend our lives trying to do what only God can do, to create a community of memory in an amnesic world. The way of indirection may inadvertently underwrite the biblical illiteracy that is abroad today. The point is not to give in to the amnesia, but to address it with clarity and confidence. A fourth view of narrative preaching associates it with the great stories of the Bible. Preaching must learn to rely on these stories, say some preachers, and not pick them to pieces. After reading the story of the call of Abraham or Nathan or David or Jesus and the Samaritan woman, how many preachers haven't said, well, who can improve on that? So the sermon is given over to the story and becomes a biblical sermon story. The story speaks for itself without the necessary hermeneutical move. The truth appears to be self-evident. Now, to those of us brought up to believe in the perspicuity of the Scriptures, the story sermon seems to be the answer to the dilemma. Likewise, in biblical studies today, much attention is paid to literary criticism. The goal of literary criticism is to analyze plot, characterization, tone, atmosphere, style of the piece of literature without reference to historical or authorial intent. How does the story work on its own terms? There is much in literary criticism that is useful to the preacher. When I discern the structure of many Johannine narratives, for example, I will avoid focusing on incidentals and align my sermons with the power of John's narrative. If I note the affinity between the parable of the dishonest steward and the picaresque novel, I may help you understand that character and yourself a little better. Or, if I help a congregation see Mark's technique of focal images, we will be more likely to enjoy the story and less likely to miss its point. And it does have a point. Literary criticism at one level and story sermons at another both tend to get lost in the sense, the texture of the story, forgetting that the story has a reference in God, in the tradition, and in human experience. When listeners leave a story sermon asking, "So what?" it's not necessarily because they are literary Philistines. Poems, parables, and especially sermons are about something. Biblical texts do suggest images and facilitate experiences, but they also imply purposes and point to references beyond themselves in ways that are susceptible to synthetic formulation. Now, this is not a license to distill a story into points, as if a child, for example, would be satisfied to hear the point of a bedtime story rather than to experience it in its fullness. But it does help explain why the sermon story seems so incomplete and why the listener may feel unengaged by it. Perhaps we need a story of stories by which to norm all the stories we tell in the pulpit. In fact, Christians do have such an interpretive key to stories. It is the story of the death and resurrection of Jesus. Many of the gospel stories are paradigms of this story. Although plot and characterization show much about Jesus and his story, it is through these plot and characterization that his death and resurrection make their appearance in everyday life. The stories we have in the Synoptic Gospels tell what it's like to be dead and raised again in Jesus Christ. But the application of the story of stories to all the other stories we tell yields a different kind of language. It leads inexorably to direct address or dialogue. It leads to Pauline-like language of the cross that assumes the validity of the story, articulates its benefits, and then in dialogic fashion gives them away. I'm not going to try to answer the question whether the language of direct address arose as an interpretation of the stories, or if the stories arose as commentaries on the kerygmatic proclamations. We don't want to get impaled on the horns of that dilemma, because the church wasn't. From the beginning, it included both kinds of language in its canon, its worship, and its preaching. Now let me add a final category of narrative. And this is narrative preaching, but slightly unrelated to the other categories. I shift from the use of story, which is likely to imply either anecdotes or the story sermon, both of which have their problems, I think, to a notion of the sermon that unfolds with a linear or narrative logic. Such preaching may not be filled with stories, that is, self-contained vessels of plot and characterization, but the entire sermon will be plot-like in its development. What do I mean by that? If a sermon is like a plot, it will have a point and a purpose. For the reader or viewer of a detective mystery, there's nothing more frustrating than a pointless episode. Furthermore, while the story or episode will not announce its purpose, it will nevertheless achieve some purpose in the reader. The point of the sermon is the center or burden of the text discovered through exegesis. The purpose of the text will not usually be stated, but careful attention to form, setting, and literature will enable the preacher to know what this episode is trying to achieve. Since this pericope is always an expression or an episode of that story of stories, the interpreter will always ask, how did this text preach in the church? To meditate on this same point, purpose, and power in terms of the contemporary church is to prepare a sermon. Like any good plot, the sermon will not be static. Although Fosdick counseled preachers, tell all you know in the first sentence, this sermon will not necessarily announce the whole of its truth in the first sentence or even in the first paragraph. The first sentence is meant to invite the hearer along on a journey, not describe the destination. That's like telling the punchline at the beginning rather than at the end of the joke. When I think of English prose, the master of first lines has to be George Orwell. Let me share a few of my favorite first lines with you. The first sentence of his autobiographical essay, Such Were the Joys, goes like this. Soon after I arrived at Crossgates, not immediately, but after a week or two, just when I seemed to be settling into the routine of school life, I began wetting my bed. Or from another essay, the first sentence reads, as I write, highly civilized human beings are flying overhead, trying to kill me. Or from another essay, Marakich, this inviting first sentence. As the corpse went past, the flies left the restaurant table in a cloud and rushed after it. But they came back a few minutes later. These lines do not tell all he knows, to be sure, but they convince the reader that there is much that might be known here. The sermon is not meant to present the exterior of a house or a library that one can see all at once. It's more like an invitation into the building to explore it room by room. A sermon is not a painting, but a symphony that unfolds in movements. The movement of a sermon, however, is never predetermined for the sake of form alone. It follows the logic of the gospel as it is epitomized in the text. It must reach a climax in which the concerns of rhetoric and theology come together. What is the climax in a sermon? The climax occurs when the point of the text is unfolded according to the purpose of the text, with the utmost clarity and intensity in terms of the capacities and needs of the persons present in the congregation. It is the moment of transaction when the preacher makes it clear that he or she is giving away something and the congregation makes it clear that it is accepting it. In Greek tragedy, it would have been called the recognition scene. In the cantata, it's the chorale. When it occurs, things happen, not only intellectually in the content of the speech, but also rhetorically in the preacher's demeanor and voice, and, as scientific studies have shown, in the actual physiological goings-on in the listeners. Now, it's important to say again that narrative logic does not imply a string of anecdotal gems, each with its own luster. Narrative logic is aware of the larger stories, the superstories, whose themes influence our lives so profoundly, and in whose simple plots we are all enmeshed. The sermon may weave together witnesses and analyses, arguments, metaphors, plots, from the massive traditions with which our Bible and our culture abound. so long as everything in the sermon moves in explicit fealty to and execution of God's promise of grace. Although operating according to a narrative logic, such preaching should not invest in the narrative genre to the extent that it's ashamed somehow of the word of direct address. Your sins are forgiven. As I mentioned in the first lecture, Luther was a master of preaching's two languages, narrative and address. And in his most luminous sermons, he punctuates the former with the latter. On the afternoon of Christmas Day 1530, Luther retold the story of the Nativity with incomparable virtuosity in the use of narrative, metaphor, imagery, and apostrophe. After telling the story, he suddenly drops the storyteller's mask and pierces the veil that is always there between artifact and audience by concluding, and I quote, "Now if this is all true, and it is the truth, then let everything else go. And at a distance of 450 years, the reader feels like letting everything else go." Brothers and sisters in Christ, we have the high and dangerous calling to tell true stories in a world that is filled with lies. The sermons we preach are true to the unfinished quality of experience and true to the pilgrim character of God's community. But they are truest of all to the essential texture and temporality of God's self-revelation in Jesus Christ, who is, and who was, and who is to come, the Almighty. The Almighty.